From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been around for years. Mobile payments. Take out your phone, swipe it, and walk away with your purchase. But it's not quite caught on. With the new iPhone 6 and the promise of Apple Pay, that could change, making paying for goods in stores, online, easier and more secure. This hour on Point, a new frontier in how we pay for goods. You can join us on air or online. Are you ready to ditch your credit card? Do you see the promise of mobile payments? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, how creditors can take money directly out of your paycheck. But first, joining me now from New York City is Ruth Reeder. She's a writer for the online technology news site VentureBeat. Ruth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So let me set up our conversation this hour with Apple CEO Tim Cook, who unveiled Apple Pay in his keynote this month. He said that other companies have tried and failed to make mobile payment products work.
Most people that have worked on this have started by focusing on creating a business model that was centered around their self-interest instead of focusing on the user experience. We love this kind of problem. This is exactly what Apple does best. And so we've created an entirely new payment process, and we call it Apple Pay.
So it's been around for years, but what's new about this? Ruth, what's new about Apple Pay? What is it exactly and what will it do?
Sure. So Apple Pay is a new payment application, and it's featured on the latest iOS. So it'll basically be on iPhone 6 and 6 Plus and the new Apple Watch. And so what's different about it is that it makes use of near-field communication technology, or NFC technology. And what that allows you to do is have your phone and make payments with it at a terminal in a store, for example. And there have been other companies that have tried to do this. Google Wallet has tried. But Apple may be set up to do it a little bit better.
So, all right. So consumers aside for the moment, how are retailers reacting? Are merchants partnering with Apple? I mean, what technologies will they have to adopt to make this actually work?
Well, merchants are a little bit skeptical, but Apple has gotten a few on board, and these are some of the early adopters. So you have people like Subway and Walgreens and Macy's and Bloomingdale's are a couple of the people who are on board. I think McDonald's and Whole Foods as well. And so these are people who already had some of this technology because they were looking to get in on it early. Other than them, there's been a little bit of resistance. I know that Best Buy and I believe Walmart has said that they probably will not integrate. And the reason for that is that it's expensive. You have to have terminals that cost anywhere from $250 to $300 per terminal. And then on top of that, there's installation costs and there are also infrastructure costs. So it's a lot to ask of merchants.
Big adoption curve for some smaller vendors, for sure. This is launching amid some real high-profile security breaches at retailers like Home Depot and Target. A lot of people are thinking about security these days. How secure is this sort of payment system?
So what Apple has done has put a focus on security, which is pretty smart considering the recent breaches. And what they've done is they're using a token system. So basically, they don't store your credit card number. Instead, they replace it with a token number, which is a random set of numbers and letters. And then in addition to that, they also issue a token transaction number for each transaction that you have. So again, randomized numbers, it would be very difficult to hack. You couldn't really use skimmers, which are a lot of what's used to hack into retail systems to get credit card numbers and then access that information and make payments and all of that. So from a security standpoint, right now, Apple's looking pretty good. And a lot of people in the security community have said as much as well.
Let me bring in another voice here from New York, Jason Buchweitz. He's associate director of the Columbia Institute for Teleinformation at Columbia Business School. He is also an attorney. Jason, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So how do you see this? Are mobile payments sort of the end of the wallet here, the end of cash as we know it?
Well, I'd like to say that it is. I've been trying to get rid of my wallet now for a good 3 years. It might be. It might be the start of it, but it's going to be a very long evolution and change. What we're seeing is, yes, Apple is coming in and they're bringing in a whole lot of new people into this field. Already Apple has already sold 10 million iPhone 6 Plus. So there's a lot of the people out there now who have access to this technology. But this technology is not new, as you've said. It's been around for 3 years. And it's actually even been around a little bit longer than that. Before mobile payment, we've seen PayPass with MasterCard and Visa, where basically the same RFID technology similar to NFC was embedded into the credit card itself. So you could just tap the credit card to the terminal and pay that way without swiping it. What Apple has really done, and this is where they're probably going to get a lot of more merchants on board, is Apple has somehow convinced the credit card companies to treat the payment as a card-present payment instead of a card-not-present payment, which is how all NFC-based transactions have been treated in the past. And the difference there is how much in fees the merchant has to pay. So generally with a card-present transaction, when the customer is there and swipes their card, the merchant pays about 1.5%, 1.75% of the transaction to the card company. When a card is not present, they pay as much as 2.75% of the transaction or higher. So every time somebody uses a Google Wallet transaction, the company is paying more money. This is why they may not want to adopt it, because they'd rather have somebody swipe the card and pay less than tap the card and pay more. Apple has convinced these companies, because of the biometrics, because of the token system, and because of Apple, that it should be treated as card present. So that might help getting people to get on board merchant-wise, which will then further roll out adoption.
So they've whittled that number down. You've been using Google Wallet for years now, Jason. Tell us how that has worked for you.
Well, personally, it's a lot of fun when you first start. It's really cool. You walk into the store, you know, you pull out your phone, you tap it, everybody's looking at you because, oh, wow, he's doing something different than everybody else. So it's kind of a kind of an attention grabber that some people like to do as well. There are some issues. First and foremost is it requires internet connectivity. So if you're in a location that doesn't have the greatest connection, so you know, for Grand Central, I have to travel in and out all the time. Every now and then, you know, there's a lot of people in Grand Central Station in the morning. And so what will happen is the cell networks are overloaded and the data is slowed to a halt. So you're standing there, you tap your phone, and you're waiting 3 minutes for the authentication to go through on the phone end. Or if your battery is about to die, you also have that fear now of, my wallet is now gone because if my battery dies, I can't make any sales or transactions. So what I end up having to do anyway is I'm still walking around with a wallet. I have a backup credit card and I have my ID because I can't get rid of either of those two things yet.
So those are some of the barriers to technology. Ruth, do you think those barriers are too difficult to overcome or not?
Not necessarily. And one of the reasons is, well, one, Apple has done a lot to improve battery life. The second is that they introduced the Apple Watch, which can also be used to make payments. And I think that's really one of the best things that they've done that's different from its competitors, is that you can actually walk out of the house and make a payment with your watch, which is such a nutty idea, isn't it? You don't have to have your wallet. You don't have to have your cell phone nearby. You just have this watch and you can tap it on the go.
But the technology, I mean, the watch aside, this technology, as you stated, has been around before. This isn't new. So I'm curious, you know, besides the interest rates that have been whittled down, negotiated down by Apple, I mean, are people really ready for this, Jason Buckwitz?
I don't think so. I think that there will be a bit of a quick interest in a fad interest where people will walk out of the house and say, wow, this is really cool. I saw about this. I heard about this. People are talking about it. Let me try it. They're going to try it a couple of times, and then invariably they're going to go back to the old way of doing things. It's a comfort level. You know, people have been conditioned over and over again that you walk to the, you know, walk to the register, pull out your card, swipe it, go through, sign, and walk away. There's going to be, especially in the older generations, you know, people in their 30s, 40s, et cetera, who have been doing this now for 20, 30 years, a kind of relearning. And what I've seen with people, when even my friends who I've let try this because I, you know, they go, oh, I'd love to see how this works. There's a bit of a reticence there of, hey, this is a little different than what I'm used to, and it makes me a little scared. So again, it may be something that people are willing to try a couple of times. You know, oh, I'm getting out of the cab. Let me tap and pay. Oh, that was fun. Ha ha. But I don't think it's going to be long-term something that people are going to say, oh, I'm going to make every single one of my transactions just by tapping my phone.
And so, Ruth Reeder, what's the time frame for success, to measure success with this brand new technology sort of used in a different way now?
I think that Apple is playing the long game. So they've timed this very well. I mean, Visa and MasterCard have already said that they're trying to move to chip and PIN technology for their cards. So we're already looking to do sort of a tapping interface with cards. And Apple knows this. I think that they're introducing it now so people can sort of play around with it and maybe forget about it and then maybe come back to it down the road. I think that they're planning for that buffer.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at moving your wallet onto your phone this hour with mobile payments, and you can join the conversation. Buying a phone that can handle mobile payments is expensive. Will this further separate the haves from the have-nots in our society? With all the credit card breaches, do you feel like ratcheting back, going back to cash rather than plunging into mobile? We're talking with Ruth Reeder this hour. She's a writer at Venture Beat, and with Jason Buchwitz, Associate Director of the Columbia Institute for Teleinformation at Columbia Business School. Here's some more sound. Once again, Apple CEO Tim Cook unveiling Apple Pay this month, showing a video of a woman rummaging through her purse, struggling with her wallet, scanning her ID, swiping her card twice, and finally leaving the register. Cook says that paying should be an easier experience.
Every day between credit and debit, we spend $12 billion. That's over $4 trillion a year, and that's just in the United States. And this business is comprised of over 200 million transactions a day. That's 200 million times that we scramble for our credit cards and go through what is a fairly antiquated payment process.
And this is a 2012 ad about Google Wallet, released by Google in 2011, describing a payment system that lets users store credit and debit cards on their cell phones.
What if your wallet was engineered rather than sewn? What if you were struck by a better idea? What if your wallet was a Google Wallet? It would start with your cards, credit and debit. Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover. All stored securely in the cloud. All your cards all together in a virtual wallet that goes anywhere.
Jason Buchwitz, I mean, Google Wallet saves past transactions, as I understand this. Apple Pay does not. Can you explain why the companies took different approaches to this?
Well, Google is at its base form, it's an advertising company. What Google cares about most is being able to gain data so that it can properly create a profile to then sell to advertisers. Google wants the idea of knowing your transaction history for a very particular purpose. It's able to then turn around and sell different ad ideas to other companies. So with Google Wallet, one of the features that is some people think nice, some people think a little Orwellian, is that as you're walking around, it will use the GPS built into the phone to know where you are and know that you, let's say, shop often at Target. And it Target will then send you a coupon to use on your Google phone and through your Google wallet for maybe $5 off a $50 purchase or something like that. But what's actually happening is, of course, Google is telling Target that you're nearby. Target is saying, hey, I'm going to pay for some advertising to bring him into my shop. And you're now getting a discount coupon, which is nice. But Google, of course, is making a profit. Apple's – we don't really know what Apple is doing in the background here. This is all still talk. What we do know is Apple is not an advertising company. Apple is an agency company. Apple, my guess, is trying – has negotiated rates with the card companies to possibly take a portion of the transaction. So like I said before, it's a 1.5% transaction for per card present. Maybe they've negotiated a rate where they're paying Visa 1.25%, the merchant is paying 1.5%, and Apple keeps 0.25% of the transaction. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of money, and it's really not per transaction, but you heard Tim Cook saying before in the narrative, there's 200 million transactions a day in the United States. If you can get 0.25% on 200 million transactions every single day, that's a lot of money.
Let me get some listeners in here. Dylan is first up in Austin, Texas. Hi, Dylan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there. It's been a situation where, you know, we're, as somebody said, we're going to chip and pin, and Europe has kind of already committed itself that way. So what's the likelihood of people committing themselves to yet another new technology? I mean, Walmart has already gone very much chip and pin, and I think they're going to be committed. So what's the likelihood of other vendors swapping out chip and pin in, and now they got another one?
Dylan, thank you. Ruth Reeder?
I would say, well, two things. One is that with those readers, some of them come equipped for both EMV and NFC. So there's that, and I think it's just a matter of turning on that portion of the reader. I think it all depends, really. I mean, it depends for merchants and it depends for consumers. I think ultimately for consumers, it will be how easy is this to use? And if it's not that easy, and if it's easier to just use, you know, a chip and pin card, then they'll do that. And I think for merchants, they'll respond to what consumers want.
Jason, have other countries adopted mobile payments? Dylan there, I think, mentioned places, some countries in Europe. Asia, beyond, what are you seeing out there?
Well, China specifically is very big on NFC, something like $19 billion a year in NFC payments. But the other thing I wanted to mention to Dylan is the fact that part of the reason why the adoption is going to take place, at least with chip and PIN, is because there's been a liability shift. Up until October 2015, the liability for a merchant is on the cardholder and on the card itself if somebody's doing fraudulent. After October 2015, any card that's been swiped, any possible fraud or illegal charges is on the merchant if they're not using chip and PIN. So all of the merchants are basically feeling they have to move to chip and PIN because of the liability shift. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the technology shift.
This is a liability shift then, Ruth, not technology.
Yes, it is. Sorry, I failed to mention that. But when I said earlier in our conversation that Visa and MasterCard said that they are going to be moving to chip and PIN by 2015, that was definitely what I was referring to.
Let's go to Bethany in Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Bethany. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm a middle-aged woman, and I have to remind your listeners that most of us in my age demographic, I'm 46, grew up with Apple products. And we may not have had them from childhood, but we've been early adopters and using them for a long time. And I feel like the Apple technology is going to make payments so much easier and be incredibly useful. I've had two credit cards and ATM cards canceled in the last 2 months, and I keep having to get new cards. And I feel like credit cards have become such a problem due to data breaches that security protocols through automatic payments can change on the fly. So it seems to me that encryption would be actually better and more secure than a static credit card number. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, Bethany, thank you. I mean, not to focus on Apple here so much, what if you're an Android user? Jason, what if you've got a different phone?
The token system is a system that's been around for a long time. It actually started over in Europe, specifically with a company I believe called Orbscom, which is based out of Ireland. And they were the ones that pioneered the idea of what's called a controlled number, a controlled payment number, which is basically this idea of a token system where there's a virtual number associated with your account that is used for one time and one time only. Apple has been the first company to really push this forward. Now, individual banks have been doing this for a while. So, you know, you could go online to Citibank, and if you want to make an online payment and you don't want to give up your credit card because you're worried that somebody's going to intercept it and steal it, and then you have to go through all the identity theft problems, you can log into your Citibank account, ask for a one-time use number. It generates the number, you punch it in, and that's it. There's no risk of fraud because it's a one-time use number that gets thrown out after that. There's no way to trace it back to you. There's no way to steal it, et cetera. And this technology has been around since 2006, 2007. Apple has been smart that they're the first company to really integrate it into their system. But there's no reason why Google can't, or SoftCard, or LevelUp, or any of the other mobile payment companies that are either on Android or on Windows or on anything, really.
Let's go to Tom in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listening to your program today is confusing the daylights out of a 74-year-old geezer. I'm just wondering if people of my age and going backwards into their, say that their 40s and 50s, you know, the boomer generations and just before them, are going to be willing to take on this need to buy all sorts of expensive technology because so many commercial outfits may want to change their method of payments. And what kind of device do you need to use to carry around these Androids and i6s and i7s and i9s and whatever generations Apple's going to come up with? It sounds like you guys sound like you're pandering to Apple, if you don't mind my saying so. If I came into this program in the middle, I'd think it was an ad for Apple. And since you seem to be thinking that Apple is about the major company that is taking the lead in getting this new payment structure set up and on the go, how long is it going to be before it becomes a requirement where merchants stop taking cash, checks, credit cards, debit cards, and so forth, and start requiring that their customers use these technological whiz bangs? Thanks very much.
Tom, thank you. Ruth Reeder, respond, please.
Sure. Well, I think that's a little extreme. I don't think that it's going to ever be so severe that merchants will stop taking cash or even necessarily cards. I mean, part of this you have to remember is that not everybody has an iPhone, and that's going to be a huge part. I think the reason that people have been so gung-ho about Apple Pay specifically is because it is so popular. In terms of getting – and it's been really good at getting new technology pushed forward. And in some ways, it may be good for the community as a whole, and that's sort of the other thing. So like Jason was saying, you know, consumers have other options. It doesn't have to just be Apple Pay. It can be SoftCard now. So there will be multiple options for mobile wallets. And then in addition to that, like we said earlier, you know, there's also a movement towards chip and PIN cards. And I don't think that we're going to just suddenly jump over that and miss that whole technological phase.
Jason, do you want to chime in here?
Yeah, I definitely think we're never going to get to a point where cash is eliminated. Though there are people of my ilk who would be very happy about that. I personally don't ever really carry cash on me. I don't think it's ever going away. My mother has a near-field communication-enabled phone. She's used it. She looks at it and she's scared of it. It's hard enough for me to get her to use a credit card, let alone to use her phone as a credit card. I think that generation, I do think there is going to be a split in the people who are going to use it and the people who are going to just be like, this is too confusing for me. This is too much. There are a lot of technologies out there. Now, what's going to be good is that this push is going to push out deployment. I've had Google Wallet since December of 2011. It's been very hard to find places that have the correct reader for it. What's going to happen now is you're going to start to see more and more merchants that will have NFC-enabled readers. Well, what does that mean? Well, there's no specific reader for Apple Pay. It means that if Target now has it for Apple Pay, it also has it for Google Wallet, it has it for SoftCard, it has it for Stripe, it has it for Klinkle, it has it for all of these other ones as well.
I'm reading from our Facebook page. Mike Porter says, I've been using Google Wallet with my Moto X on and off for the last 4 months. Most stores don't have the terminals, or the clerks don't feel like making it work. To your point, Jason, let's go to Mark in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. I've been a technologist for many years, and one of the things I'm hearing here is a suggestion that basically whenever a company wants to disparage an older technology, one of the things they push is the divide between young and old. Well, maybe I'm too old, but I'm scared of this not because of age or because of the way things have been done in the past, but because maybe I know too much about vulnerabilities. And one of the most obvious ones is that if you have a physical object, a credit card, and it doesn't degrade, it doesn't deteriorate the same way. You drop it in, say, in a puddle, you still got a piece of plastic with a scrape on it or a chip in it. You take your smartphone, you drop it in a puddle, and you've got a nice, interesting piece of sculpture that no longer functions. You can no longer pay for anything. There are a million technological reasons why this is a bad idea, and it sounds like Google and Apple and the other technology companies are instead trying to essentially herd the sheep by using this age divide as a way to disparage the older approaches that have worked for a long time.
Mark, thank you. Thank you. We hear it. Ruth Reeder, would you respond? What if something happens to all your electronic devices? You know, there are certainly downsides.
I agree. I'm certainly not an evangelist for Apple Pay or any of the other wallets. I think that this is one thing that they're going to have to address, and they haven't yet. And part of that is also, Apple Pay isn't here yet. It's not rolling out until October, from what I understand.
Jonathan is in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
I had a question. One of the reasons why I've sort of stayed away from adopting something like Google Wallet is because I take advantage of some of the incentives that the credit card companies give, things like cash back and frequent flyer miles and so on. And I haven't seen any motivation to move to a Google Wallet. I stay away from using my debit card for the same reason. As long as I pay off my credit card on a monthly basis, there's no charge to me, and I get this benefit of either 1.5% cash back or frequent flyer miles on my favorite airline. Mm-hmm. Is there any thoughts about how that fits into this model?
Jonathan, thank you. Jason Buckwhites.
Well, there's really no difference. All we're talking about here is a change in how the card itself is presented. You're still going to get your frequent flyer miles. You're still going to get your cash back. Google Wallet or Apple Pay or any of these systems doesn't suddenly change and change that. That's a deal that you have negotiated and worked out with your card company. The way that Google Wallet and Apple Pay will work is you log in, you load in your card information, and it stores it, and what is happening is Apple or Google or whomever is then charging the amount to your credit card company, just as if you presented the card to your store, and basically there's no way for you to even know when you get your statement in the mail that it was paid with NFC versus whether it was paid by you swiping the card itself or using chip and PIN.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about a new era of payments, mobile payments, that is. We're speaking this hour with Ruth Reeder. She's a writer at VentureBeat, and with Jason Buckwhites, Associate Director of the Columbia Institute for Teleinformation at Columbia Business School. This month, when Apple jumped into mobile payments with Apple Pay, PayPal came out with a full-page newspaper attack ad claiming that Apple's payment system would be as insecure as celebrity photos stored in iCloud. We the people, the ad reads, want our money safer than our selfies. PayPal's We the People mantra factored into this ad as well.
We are the people who have built a whole new place to live, dream, be. We employ ourselves
and vote with our money.
Our phone is our wallet.
We can spend Bitcoin with a tap.
Without a pocket.
We can buy and sell and rent and send and lend a 20 to a friend.
From the coffee bar and share car, we are unstoppable with our thumbs.
Just one touch to buy just about anything.
Just one touch to buy almost anything. Ruth Reeder, does this sound to you like technology companies are becoming more and more involved in our financial lives? Is that where this is leading?
It very well could be. I mean, actually, in some ways, it already is the truth, right? I mean, we have, you know, person-to-person opportunities for payment via mobile. We have, you know, before that, PayPal has been allowing us to make payments on eBay and other e-commerce sites for years. So I think that technology companies have been forging a path into our financial lives for some time now.
How do you see it, Jason?
Very similarly, technology is moving at a rapid pace, and it's looking to fix basically every one of the ills of society. And one of the things that it sees as a problem is that we haven't changed at all since the 1950s and 1960s in how we handle financial transactions. It's coming with a lot of ideas because there's a lot of money to be made. And, you know, what they say is where there's the money, there's going to be ideas. So I definitely see this as being more and more of our daily lives is going to be technology in some way.
So, Jason, put your lawyer hat on for a moment. And with these mobile payment devices, do you believe that we'll start thinking of these tech companies more as financial institutions, essentially banks that need to be regulated, Jason?
That is a very, very interesting question, and that's a question that is something that needs to be addressed. These companies are going to have to start thinking about the fact that are they an enabler or are they actually a bank? Now, PayPal, for the most part, is treated as a bank, and that's due to the fact that it does act as a means of actually transactions. You know, I have money sitting in an account bearing interest, though it's not much, in a PayPal account. Apple and Google don't allow you to really do that yet. Google is starting to, and Apple may as well. And when that starts to happen, then you're going to really have to take a long regulatory look and say, hey, these are companies that are holding money, they're transacting money, there's huge amounts of things at risk. Do we need to start treating them as a bank for money laundering purposes, for security purposes, for FDIC insurance purposes? What happens if Apple tomorrow goes out of business? Do I lose my money? Well, right now, yeah, I do.
Well, that said, isn't PayPal already reporting some of its larger transactions to the government?
So that has to deal with the anti-money laundering acts, and a lot of that stems out of 9/11. After that, there were some changes done to how the United States handles reporting for transactions, and in order to prevent money from ending up in the wrong hands, they've created and adopted systems that allow certain transactions to automatically be marked and sent to the government so that the government is aware of large sums of money changing hands. Now, that sum varies from person to person based on histories and how much money they make and things like that, what their normal spending habits are. PayPal, for instance, does automatically report large transactions in and out to the government, both for tax purposes and for fraud purposes. Apple and Google right now don't, and they may have to because it may become a system for transferring money for either licit or you know, wrong things. One of the things that hasn't been brought up yet is Square. So Square Reader is a device that you can attach to your phone. You can swipe a credit card with and transfer money to your Square account for a small transaction fee. Now, what's really interesting there is it basically sets me up as a credit card processor. So what I can realistically do is I can buy the Square Reader. It's $9.99 in your local Radio Shack. Plug it into my phone, take my credit cards and treat them as a swipe, move money from my credit card account to my banking account. And I can do this without having to pay cash advance interest rates. If you ever look at your credit card statements, the cash advance interest rate is usually like 30%, and the credit card interest rate is, you know, sometimes lower, sometimes as the same. But all of a sudden now I can be moving money from my credit card to my checking account and use that money. Should I be able to? You know, should I be paying the same interest? There's a lot of questions here to be asked with that.
There are a lot of questions. Ruth, what about this notion that these mobile payment systems create yet another divide between the haves and the have-nots, those who can afford this kind of technology, who will use it, and those who can't, and those who won't?
It's an interesting question for sure, but I think that, I mean, nobody's ever going to be barred from making transactions. Some people will be able to and want to adopt this new technology. But the other thing to keep in mind with that, I mean, I can't really comment on the people who don't want to, you know, adopt new technology. That's sort of their business.
It's more the question of those who can't.
More of a question of those who can't. Well, on that note, you know, this is just an evolving technology right now. And as technology evolves, it gets cheaper always. And I think we're going to see that happening really quickly. So for now, it is and may be a question of have and have nots. But I also think that as time goes on, I think that divide will be less potent.
After mobile payments, Jason Buchweitz, what's next? What do you see on the horizon? Where does this lead us?
Well, one of the interesting things is where I see this going is into a field of online payments. We still are an antique way of paying online. You got to pull out your credit card. You got to type everything in. One of the interesting things is vertical integration with Apple, because Apple is all about their ecosystem, et cetera, is moving the Apple Pay system directly into Safari, their web browser, on their computers. This is something that they can definitely do, which in theory could be done without the need for change on the merchant side. And what I'm saying here basically is when you log in, you have to enter in your shipping information, your billing information, all of that. This can all be stored in the Apple payment system. Let it handle everything, and with one click, everything is paid for and shipped to you.
Well, more to come. An interesting start this hour. Thank you very much. Jason Buchweitz, Associate Director of the Columbia Institute for Teleinformation at Columbia Business School. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
And Ruth Reeder, writer for Venture Beat. Appreciate your time, Ruth. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, when creditors take money directly out of your paycheck. This is On Point. The word garnish brings to mind an extra flourish on a thoughtfully cooked meal. For creditors, garnishing wages means taking a nice chunk, in some states up to 25% of after-tax wages, to pay down debts. Sometimes the money is taken directly out of a bank account. It can come as a severe blow to people trying to get to just make ends meet. Joining me now from Boston is NPR correspondent Chris Arnold. He teamed up with ProPublica's Paul Keel for the new series Unforgiven, The Long Life of Debt. Nice to have you with us, Chris. Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely. Hi, Jane.
Can you define what it means to have your wages garnished exactly?
Sure. So what this means is that someone you owe money to, usually it's a debt collector that does this, that has a lawyer, they will sue you in court and say, Jane owes us money. And often what happens here, though, is that the person who's being sued gets served with papers, a big stack of papers, and somewhere in there it says, hey, there's this court hearing and you should go. A lot of the time in parts of the country we went to, more than half the time, the debtors don't actually show up, and that results in a default judgment against them. And when that happens, the creditors, the credit card companies or hospitals or whoever is suing, get broad powers to garnish wages, which means your employer has to give up to 25% of your paycheck to the debt collector. And there's no protection for your bank account. So in many, many states across the country, they can take everything in your checking account if they can figure out where your bank is and do that.
So by law then, Chris, who can garnish your wages? Is it just debt collectors and creditors?
Well, this is interesting, and this is what is new. Just about anybody can do it if they file suit. But for decades, wage garnishment has been used by the courts to make sure that fathers pay child support. It was the whole, you know, deadbeat dads thing, or the government, if you owe taxes, they have ways of garnishing your wages. And that's still a big chunk of it. But what's new here is that nobody understood how much this was going on for just regular old consumer debt, like, you know, credit cards, medical bills. And even national experts that we talked to, they say that they were taken aback by what we found here. Mm.
So give us an example. Share a story of someone in this position.
Okay. Well, one person we could talk about, I'm flipping through my notes here, is a woman named Cassandra Rose, who lives in Omaha, Nebraska. She and her husband are in their 30s, and they have two kids, you know, trying to get by. The recession was tough on them. Her husband lost his job for a while. And along the way, she starts getting just these debilitating headaches where, you know, it's scary kind of stuff. She gets up, she's dizzy, she's falling down. It goes on for months, and they don't have health insurance. And she's saying, I don't want to go to the hospital. Her husband finally says, look, a friend of mine, he died of an aneurysm. You got to go. You know, you can imagine this sort of dramatic conversation that I'm sure plays out in lots of households around the country. So she goes to the hospital. They say, whoa, this could be a brain tumor. There's an MRI done, all these tests. And then all of a sudden, literally overnight, you know, when she gets out of the hospital, they say, well, it looks like it's just migraines. But she owes $20,000 for MRI bills and other stuff and figures, well, I can't, you know, pay that. I can barely pay for the dentist for my kids, you know. So she doesn't pay it. And before she knows it, all of a sudden, 25% of her paycheck's being taken by creditors that the hospital sued her through a debt collection company.
So does she have any recourse in the process?
Not really. I mean, a lot gets lost if the creditor, or if the debtor, sorry, doesn't show up in court at that hearing. I mean, there's a hearing, there's a judge, you know, and for whatever reason, for a bunch of different reasons, people don't show up, whether they figure it's hopeless or they never really understand that that's even a possibility to go to the court. So, you know, when that happens, there's this default judgment, and then it's a court order. You know, her employer has to take the money out of her paycheck.
And
if you owe $20,000, that could go on for years and years and years. And, you know, one recourse might be bankruptcy. That has always been a way that people who are just getting crushed by debt can – it was sort of the answer to debtor's prison, you know, in this we used to have back in England and stuff. But a lot of these people we talked to said, look, I don't even have the $3,000 to hire a lawyer to declare bankruptcy. It's like they can't even afford bankruptcy. Mm.
Chris Arnold is a correspondent for NPR. He teamed up with ProPublica's Paul Keel for this new series, Unforgiven, The Long Life of Debt. How many people are experiencing this, Chris? How many people are having their wages garnished? How widespread is this now?
Well, this is really interesting, too. And there were no good national numbers about this before we did this series. And Paul Keel, my partner, went to ADP, which is a big payroll company, and this was a really smart move because they deal with millions and millions of employees and their paychecks. So they could look at a sample of 13 million Americans and extrapolate from that. And what they found is that 1 in 10 working Americans between the ages of 35 and 44 are getting their wages garnished. And that's just a huge percentage of the population, obviously. And nearly half the time, that's over credit card debt now and medical bills or student loans. So there's been a real sea change in how debt collectors are using the courts here to collect debts.
Has there been any legislation to this point?
Well, consumer advocates are now saying there needs to be more. The big law that oversees a lot of this goes all the way back to 1968, and apparently there was a fight between the Senate and the House, and, you know, some people wanted a lower threshold than 25% of people's wages. But the idea was, well, states' rights, and the states will come in and, you know, they'll pass tougher protections for folks. So that ended up being this very arguably high level. I mean, getting, you know, a quarter of your pay taken week after week, month after month. Most people couldn't survive that. You know, surveys from the Fed show that most people can't scrape together $400 to fix their car, you know. So now that only about half the states ever went forward and created their own laws that would offer better protections for folks. Mm. So there's a feeling now that, okay, if this is happening to this many people, maybe it's time that the laws change.
Right. 1 in 10. I mean, as you say, this is becoming complicated for national employers who now have to navigate the different laws in different states, right?
Yeah, and big employers and small employers. I mean, there are small business owners who say, look, if I mess this up, I don't know how to deal with a wage garnishment. But if they do it wrong, then the small business owner can get held accountable for a debt. Some guy bought a laptop computer and never paid, and now the grocery store owner is supposed to pay it. I mean, it gets a little crazy and complicated, but there are lots of different parties that are being affected.
And if an employer does not correctly handle the garnishment order, they can actually become liable for a portion of the debt or even all of it. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah.
So tell us, just in wrapping up here, what did you learn? What does the average person need to know about wage garnishment?
Well, one giant takeaway is if you get stuck in a place where suddenly you can't pay your bills and people are coming after you, if you get something in the mail that says, look, there's a court hearing, show up, appeal to the judge, ask what your options are, try to get a lawyer. There are ways to push back against this, but if people bury their head in the sand, a lot of bad things can happen.
That's NPR's Chris Arnold. He teamed up with ProPublica's Paul Keel for this new series, Unforgiven, The Long Life of Debt. You can read a series on our website at onpointradio.org. Thanks so much, Chris. Really appreciate you coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.